Hi, welcome to the podcast, The Socially Inspired Investor, where you can not only expand your knowledge of rewarding investment strategies, but also address environmental and socially responsible investing alternatives with important insights from experts in the field. I'm Pat O'Neill. These programs feature ESG, environmental, social, and governance stories in focus, and deep dive discussions with notable people in the industry. This time, the topic, net zero carbon. What is it? What are companies doing to achieve it? And is it possible? Also featured in companion articles in the Socially Inspired Investor Digest at sociallyinspiredinvestor.com. We hear a lot about net zero carbon these days, but what does that really mean? And how is it affecting investors and the world around us? We have two guests to talk about very different aspects of this issue. A little later, we'll talk to Cornelia Levy-Benchetin, marketing consultant and smart cities expert, and author of the new book, Smart Cities, Smart Future, showcasing tomorrow. First, let's welcome Mark Campanale, founder and executive chairman of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, a nonprofit think tank which does research on the impact of climate change on financial markets and investors. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us more about the Carbon Tracker Initiative, what it is and what it does.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit financial think tank, and we're set up about 10 years ago. Myself and a colleague, we worked in a large financial institution in the City of London, then called Henderson Global Investors. And we've had a few ideas around our concern about climate change and what investors were doing. And so we decided to set up this research-based group. And our goal really is to ensure that financial markets are aligned in the way that they invest with the best knowledge of the science around climate change. And that primarily means encouraging the energy transition from fossil fuels to renewables. If I tell you a little story about how things have evolved in the last years since we founded Carbon Tracker, what happened was that we produced a report called Unburnable Carbon. So we took all of the world's largest fossil fuel producing companies, coal companies and companies like Exxon and the Saudis and British companies like Shell and BP, and we analyzed their reserves, how much fossil fuels they got underground, and we calculated how much carbon dioxide that represented. And asked ourselves a question, what would happen if Shell and Exxon was to sell all of their reserves and that CO2 was to be released to the atmosphere? And we discovered it was equivalent to 3 or 4 degrees of warming, which the planet has not seen for millions, if not tens of millions of years. And it would profoundly change life on Earth as we know it. And when we produced that report, it was picked up by an American writer called Bill McKibben, and he wrote an article in Rolling Stone magazine called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. And when he read our report, which was aimed at regulators, saying to financial market regulators, look, if the companies can't develop and burn what they've already got, why are they raising more capital to develop even more? And it was aimed at regulators. Well, what Bill did is he said, well, look, what institutions should be doing is they should be divesting from fossil fuels. And off went a bunch of students who started to protest outside Harvard and Cambridge universities, and then the faith groups and then the pension fund trustees, and it really developed momentum into the divestment movement. The piece Carbon Tracker was interested in was, look, what does this mean if you're a shareholder in Exxon? And can we get investors to sit up and notice? And what can investors do? And so the genesis really of the roundtable of chief execs of oil and gas companies and institutional investors from around the world, including BlackRock and State Street and the Norwegian government pension scheme, the biggest funds in the world, was climate change is a real risk. There's an energy transition that's on its way. And how do investors talk to company management about that transition? And so the University of Notre Dame brought together a group of pension funds and oil and gas chief execs, and we met at the Vatican in 2018 and 2019, and we were supposed to have met again this year, but unfortunately, COVID took care of that. And the whole purpose really was to open a dialogue between investors and companies saying, to deal with climate change, this means a fundamental change in the oil and gas sector, and how can we work together to achieve that? And we did that in discussion with Pope Francis, who was one of the people that was there.
Are more companies seeing the advantages and benefits of adapting their practices to climate change issues, or are those companies still in the minority?
Well, the key question really is, well, firstly, it's about an allocation of capital. if there's a technology revolution that's happening, and you've got to remember that renewables, wind and solar, and plus battery storage is now cheaper in most parts of the world versus, say, gas and coal. And with that profound technology change happening, why would you bet the balance sheet of the company, the shareholder funds, why would you bet that on even more oil and gas production going out in the next 10, 20 years? So you've got a business risk problem. Let's put the climate change aside for a minute. You've got a business risk problem. Now, even if you assume that technology was not going to have the adoption rates that we know, even if we don't have that technological revolution, let's assume that you continue and carry on producing that oil and gas and coal, it would lead to significant levels of warming, unprecedented. So we've seen the ice melt in the Arctic, so 40% less ice cover than has been known in recent years. So that's changed in the last decade or so. We've seen those fires in California and in Australia. We've seen the Arctic Rim on fire in Russia. Now, imagine that getting worse. In 10 or 15 years' time, it could be that governments and policymakers intervene either with a very high carbon price, or governments could say, look, we're going to close down coal-fired power stations, or we're going to ban the sale of the internal combustion engine. Now, those two things could happen, at which point those companies that have bet the balance sheet of the company on such a misdirection, they would be caught really in a vice between governments legislating and investors walking away and the market changing with consumers switching to solar and switching to electric vehicles. So the idea that companies can just sit around and just carry on, I think would be a profound mistake. Well, the sad thing would be a mistake for the companies, but it'd be more importantly, it'd be a mistake for their shareholders, and it'd be a mistake for pension fund beneficiaries that are reliant on these companies to pay dividends to fund retirement. That's really the risk investors are facing today.
What kinds of things have you seen a carbon tracker that companies have done and are doing, good and bad, from a climate change perspective?
Yeah, well, there's three things that companies can do, and I'll tell you which one that I'm a fan of. If you're a fossil fuel company like an Exxon, you can do what Exxon and Chevron largely seem to be doing, which is business as usual, continuing to invest $20, $30 billion a year in expansion, thinking that the world's going to need more oil and gas, which I think it would be a historic error of epic proportions. Well, the second thing you can do, which is to start expanding your renewables portfolio. Now, the oil and gas companies that say, oh yeah, we've been buying a few wind farms or a few solar parks. When you look at the total percentage of investment by the oil and gas companies, it doesn't represent in aggregate more than, say, 5% of their capital expenditure. So it's symbolic. It's not really a real transformation. Or you go to the third example, which is companies like Danish Oil and Gas, used to be called Dong Energy. They just got rid of all their fossil fuels. They just closed down their oil and gas operations, and they just went 100% renewable energy. And that's why today, Ørsted, which was a tiny company, is now worth more than BP, which was one of the world's largest oil and gas companies. And it's why one of the U.S. renewable energy companies, it's the largest U.S. renewable energy company, has become worth more than Exxon. Another good example, there's a company called BP, which is, again, one of the world's largest oil and gas companies. They've announced a 40% cut in production, and they've announced a dramatic increase in investing in renewables. They've still got oil and gas, let's be clear, but their long-term strategy is to transition out in line with the science of climate goals. And it's really that third example that we need to make progress, particularly amongst oil and gas producers in the Middle East and North America as well.
It seems some companies not directly involved in the energy business are making some innovations too. For example, as I think you've mentioned, Google and Apple getting into transportation and smart vehicles. That might seem crazy, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about it.
I think you're right. I think there is a technological revolution that's happening around the world around energy and energy systems and transportation systems. And all kinds of industries are going to see a real change in their business mix. Not just because things like COVID has meant that we meet Zoom over the internet instead of meeting physically, but I think how we generate energy and how we move goods around, and that is going to undergo a profound change. Carbon Tracker, in our research, we think that something like 40% of the world's capital markets are linked in one way or another to the fossil economy. So people that make engine parts for the internal combustion engine, people that make pipelines, or they're making ships to transport oil to refineries, people that make refineries, or people that make equipment used in coal mining or coal-fired power, or even the railroads that cross the world to carrying coal to ports Now, all of that under an energy transition is essentially going to be eroded away and written down and ultimately closed. And that is the real threat at risk for pension funds, is their exposure to this old infrastructure, which they may have been allocating to private equity funds investing in oil and gas or pipelines. A lot of that's going to disappear, in my view and our view, over the next couple of decades. And it's going to come different types of businesses that are going to be revolutionary leaders in the energy transformation. The people that make the electric batteries, the people that make the solar storage systems, and energy will move from centralized power systems to localized power systems, and people will sell their solar energy from their roof into the grid, and they'll make money selling solar energy to their neighbors, or they'll have a battery storage in their basement, and during the day, the solar panel will power up the battery, and at night time, the battery will power the car or other systems. This is the change that we are seeing happening in the world around us that has profound consequences for any investor that thinks that the world will be the same in 5-10 years' time as it was 5 or 10 years ago. We think this revolution really is unstoppable.
Do you think many investors are catching on to this too and putting more pressure on companies that have not been adopting more sustainable policies?
Well, I think that's right. It's a good observation. And let's just pick on two things that have happened. Globally, the pension funds and endowments that have divested from fossil fuels has reached a commitment of $14 trillion. Now, that wasn't there a few years ago. But when it comes to actually institutional investors engaging with companies where they own shares, a new coalition was launched 2-3 years ago called Climate Action 100. It's got a great website, and it's made up of all kinds of fund managers and pension funds that look after savers' money. And that coalition, in 3 years, has become the biggest investor coalition anywhere at any time in history, having reached $46 trillion, and including BlackRock, amongst others. And that $46 trillion coalition is using the weight of investor pressure to challenge the world's largest 200 polluting companies to reduce their emissions. There's an announcement from a British fund manager called Legal & General that manages $1 trillion of pension fund money to say that they will be voting down company boards that don't implement an energy climate-focused energy transition plan, and they'll be removing directors or voting against directors that don't have proper plans in place. And they'll be selling the shares of some of the world's largest polluters. Now, that's just one fund manager. There are plenty of others that are lined up with a similar focus. Now, the reason for that, I think, comes down to one thing. Investors and pensions have a fiduciary duty to protect the interests of their pension fund beneficiaries, to maximize the return and to have a best risk-adjusted return. And these smart people are looking at what's happening to the world and saying, look, we have a fiduciary duty to protect savings and to protect the value of investments. And for that reason, we must sell the world's worst polluting companies, and we must remove company boards that are not putting in place pollution reduction programs. And that's a very opposite view, say, 10 years ago, where people said, well, the fiduciary duty is all this climate and environment can go to hell, we just make money. And of course, making money in the short term is not the right way of looking at fiduciary duty. It's about looking after people's interests over 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And of course, the fundamental breach of fiduciary duty is if there's no world worth retiring into in 30, 40 years' time. What's the point of a pension plan if the world that you want to play golf in is underwater or on fire? You know, ask people that wanted to play golf this summer in California with all the forests on fire and the day was like night, if they enjoyed playing golf rounds in their retirement whilst the air was thick with smoke. And the answer to that question is going to be no.
How do you, a carbon tracker, monitor various companies? Do you have charts and graphs you come up with on a regular basis?
That's a very, very good question. We have a team of about 30 analysts. We have people that used to work in Wall Street or the City of London, and we analyze the business plans of the world's largest oil and gas and coal companies and power and utility companies, and we work out what they need to do to transition to well below 2 degrees in their business plans, which means, in the case of oil and gas, we define that as essentially cuts in production. It's not offsetting your emissions. It's actually saying, look, the world will need less oil and gas in the future. So how much do we need to cut back our production plans or cut back our coal mining plans or the closure of coal-fired power stations? How do we need to do that? And when do we need to do that? And what are the financial consequences, implications if we don't do that? That's what Carbon Tracker publishes. And then we circulate it to some of the world's biggest investors. And they then, in turn, use our analysis I mentioned earlier Legal & General, this trillion-dollar asset manager. They're a good example of an investment manager that uses carbon trackers analytics. And there's a US one called State Street. And we've been very happy to work with our good friends at State Street in Boston, where we've been traveling with them to every major European center, city center, over the last year, well, until lockdown happened, presenting to their clients and pension fund trustees. And we're now doing webinars with them, informing them of climate risk and the energy transition. So it's all freely available. We're funded by various, you know, foundations. Any investor can download from our website, carbontracker.org, analysis, which will hopefully feed into their research. And if they're an institution that's part of Climate Action 100, they can go onto that website and download profiles on all the major companies to understand what those companies need to be doing. There's a group in California, in Oakland, called As You Sow, and they have a website called Fossil Free Funds. And Fossil Free Funds is a website that will allow you to tell which of your pension plans are exposed to fossil fuels. So it's fossilfreefunds.org is the website. And you can type the name of your retirement plan into the website, and it will tell you how much fund is exposed to fossil fuels. And that's just a practical tool any investor can use.
That's all very useful information. I was going to ask you where you get your funding. You say various foundations contribute. Do any of the entities you just mentioned or any others pay for your services?
We don't sell research. We share research. And I've got to say, we're particularly grateful to members of the Rockefeller family and Rockefeller Brothers Fund for funding Carbon Tracker from the beginning, and also to U.S. foundations like the Grantham Foundation, which was set up by Jeremy Grantham, one of the fund managers behind GMO, which is a Boston-based asset manager you may know of, and then other groups like Hewlett Foundation and the Climate Works Foundation in the U.S. Really, our philanthropic purpose really is to educate and inform financial market decision makers, whether you're a pension fund trustee, a trustee of an endowment, a college fund, or an individual that wants to take your own kind of care for your own personal investments. So we provide that research to inform and help people make better decisions.
Besides the areas Carbon Tracker is involved in now, are there other areas you're considering where you want to expand your research?
Yeah, so thank you for asking that. We're now looking really into the opportunities for the energy transition and helping to people see the kinds of switches they're making. I'm a huge fan of the potential for the hydrogen economy. The U.S. oil and gas and petrochemical industry could become a global leader in the hydrogen economy, and that is an area that we're researching. But I also recently set up another nonprofit called Planet Tracker, planet-tracker.org. And what we're looking at there is we're looking at the world's challenges facing the oceans and agriculture through the lens of financial markets with a similar kind of narrative. So one of the programs at Planet Tracker looks at seafood, and we discovered that there's over 200 stock exchange traded seafood and fisheries companies, very few of whom have a sustainable resource management plan. So they're out in the open seas catching fish as if there's no tomorrow. And we know we're bumping up against constraints, overfishing around the world. And quite a few of the fisheries are now facing distress. And this is to feed, you know, profits for investors, and which we're not against. But when you take more fish than the sea can sustainably reproduce, then actually you're threatening your core business as a company. And so Planet Tracker, we produce similar kinds of research aimed at investors and shareholders in fisheries companies. And just to bring to your listeners' attention, Rockefeller Capital Management in New York has partnered with Credit Suisse to launch a $300 million oceans fund to engage with companies involved in the oceans, whether over plastics pollution, over shipping issues, or over fisheries, to try and encourage companies and their boards to begin to be more responsible in their management of the oceans. And that's the kind of thing that we want to encourage at Planet Tracker, that will allow investors to treat their investments responsibly. Because, of course, if you've got yourself a bunch of fishing boats but no fish to catch, you're going to end up with another stranded asset, except this time it's not going to be a coal-fired power station. It's going to be fishing boats. And, of course, America, we've seen that in the cod fisheries collapse in the 1980s, where the fisheries off Newfoundland and off the north coast of North America, the cod fishery collapsed. And sadly, 20, 30,000 fishermen were put out of business because all of the fishery, the cod, had been overfished. And that's the kind of situation we want to avoid. We want to make sure that these are sustainable livelihoods for the future, for the next generation. So Planet Tracker has a program looking at at agriculture and seafood and water through the lens of financial markets, because, of course, companies, agricultural businesses are stock exchange listed too, and there they're facing similar challenges to the oceans and to energy as well. So we have a keen program and start to produce this kind of new insights, new tools for investors.
So this goes far beyond energy, this big picture. There are many other areas involved too.
Absolutely. And the interests of finance and the interests of business and the interests of the consumer and the worker should ideally all be the same, but they're not. Often the interests of the management of companies would clash with what they want to do with their workforce or the consumer. And now we're facing, I think they're facing a similar challenge with the investors. The investors want to invest for the long term. They want to invest responsibly. They want to make sure that world is a healthier place. And when they meet business folks running corporations that don't share that interest, I think you're going to get a bit of a clash. And this is all about shareholder rights. It's about shareholder democracy. It's about responsible capitalism. And it's about making sure people have a healthy, sustainably managed world to live in for future generations. And that's why it's important that this work extends beyond just what we're doing on climate.
Well, Mark, you've seen a lot over the years. Where we've come from, where we're going. As far as trends go, are you encouraged with the pace and the path we're taking? And how long will it take to achieve a substantial reduction level of carbon output?
According to the science, to avoid the worst levels of warming, we need really to critically reduce the use of fossil fuels over the next 10 years. Based on current emissions, we'll go through 1.5 degrees in about 10 or 11 years' time. That means the conditions for 1.5 degrees, which we've not seen for a million years or more. We then go through 2 degrees and then 3 degrees within 30 years, which we've not seen for 4 or 5 million years. The last time we had warming like that in the planet, London was a sweaty swamp with alligators and lions and, you know, very different place to what it is today. So time is really against us. And the question is, really, can we transition fast enough? And the International Energy Agency produced their WEO, the World Energy Outlook, and said that the speed of adoption of solar in the next decade or so is unprecedented. And they see it scaling up rapidly. And I'm confident that we have the technology and we have the capital to make that transition. The real question now is whether we have the political will to support this transition. Time is against us. Every hour is an hour less in dealing with the problem. And we just push the problem to the next generation. Except, well, the problem of the next generation is going to be a different one to ours. The problem of the next generation will be adapting and learning to survive in a critically endangered world where extreme weather events will be damaging food production and water availability. And if you're a farmer and you're trying to farm and you have extreme temperatures or extreme floods, you know, it's not going to be good for anybody. And there'll be challenges right across the economy. So the trend is we're going the right direction, but we're not going fast enough, and there are too many barriers to that change happening, sadly.
Terrific, Mark. Can you repeat that information about where listeners can learn more about you and Carbon Tracker and Planet Tracker?
You can go to carbontracker.org and you can sign up to our newsletter for free. You can follow us on Twitter at Carbon Bubble. I tweet regularly about the energy transition, and my Twitter handle is at Campanale Mark. And if you want to learn more about the role of investors and banks in the oceans, you can go to planet-tracker.org and similarly sign up to our newsletter. And we also, where we can, answer emails, and we do webinars with investors, and we do training for pension fund trustees and foundation trustees. And our role really here is to hopefully shed some light on some very complex issues. But it's profoundly important, really, that we tackle the climate crisis and the energy crisis, and investors have a role to play there too. So thank you very much.
We've been talking to Mark Campanale, founder and executive chairman of the Carbon Tracker Initiative and co-founder of Planet Tracker, which focuses on agriculture, seafood, forestry, and other industries. Back with more on the Socially Inspired Investor in a moment. Our next guest is Cornelia Levy-Bencheton, marketing consultant and smart cities expert, and author of the new book, Smart Cities, Smart Future, Showcasing Tomorrow. So Cornelia, what is a smart city and how is it different from the traditional idea of a city?
There are many definitions of a smart city, so it depends on your perspective. And that's because there are just so many different pieces, parts, components, and elements of a smart city. There's the people element, the traffic, the infrastructure, the buildings. So it's a complex system, a smart city. But the definition that I like to use is that smart cities put people first. It's all about being people-centered. It's about solving real-life problems. People in every walk of life, people of every age group, including people with disabilities. So there's really something for every kind of person in a smart city. And of course, the other definition is that it's a technology-centered city. It's taking a regular city, which is a traditional simple town, like a rural community or rural city, and making it technology-enabled. In other words, allowing technology to better life and better the conditions for people in a city. That would be my differential.
Well, we're talking a lot about energy efficiency too, right? And the carbon footprint. And I mean, we hear the phrase net zero carbon or carbon neutral. What is that exactly? And is it possible?
It's definitely possible. And it's a goal that was put forth by the United Nations in about 2015 with their sustainable development goals. So being net zero carbon or carbon neutral is something that's very good for the environment, for climate control, for reducing pollution. And we usually talk about net zero carbon around homes and buildings. And it's a kind of a hard concept to get your head around. But what it is basically is a building or a home that takes energy from the local energy provider, but that uses it in such an efficient way. Those buildings and those homes are so well built and well designed and so airtight. So they wind up selling energy back to the provider. That's kind of a very far out idea. But when you see it in action, you see that everything about a carbon neutral or a building that's designed that way is very futuristic and very advanced.
Why is the smart city movement so important? What is driving it?
The statistics show, and this is a pretty universally agreed upon, that people are moving into cities on average 1.5 million per week. Now, I know that that doesn't sound like New York City right now, but it's true all over the world that people are moving into cities at a very high rate. And projections are that about 70% of the global population will be living in cities by 2050. So the infrastructure that exists in cities right now, the buildings, the transportation, the buses and trains and how to get around in cities, the roads, just simply will collapse. They're not adequate to absorb the level that's anticipated. So it's about planning. It's about strategic long-term planning.
Is that going to make the economies of smart cities a lot better? How's that going to work?
So, of course, cities always have a budget for growth and for new projects. And I think that if you're in a local government agency and you need to spend money to fix certain things, what you want to do is not provide so much for the short term, but for the longer term. You want to have a strategic long-term direction. And it's all about cost-benefit. It's all about risk-reward. You want to have things that will be around for a long time, that will really endure, that will be resistant, sustainable, and provide for the solutions over the long term. And those usually are some sort of technology-enabled kind of solution.
Well, it seems that with so many people in cities, and that's not going to stop, it would seem that they use more energy than anybody. I mean, cities do. So it's even tougher then, it would seem, to get your arms around that, coming up with solutions.
Well, there are all kinds of solutions that are smart. There's high-tech solutions and low-tech solutions. It's funny, but a couple of examples of a low-tech solution that are smart. I know of a couple of cities in Finland that have bicycle paths that glow in the dark. So if you're out riding your bike in Finland, you have a sort of a glowy blue cobalt riding path that lights up in the dark. It's fantastic. How about crosswalks in cities that are easy to see, that are colorfully designed? There's a company out of New Haven that has an app for communicating with local governments, and they've clocked millions of uses for fixing potholes. And we know in the Northeast what a pain in the neck potholes are, and they have millions and millions of fixes all over the world. It's a global company for fixing local problems. So those are some examples of lower tech situations that are smart. One of the big problems that a city government has is in managing their garbage collection. They have all these big, noisy, polluting garbage trucks that they send out to the trash stations, the trash receptacles, and unfortunately, they're frequently empty. So the trucks get out there and there's nothing to pick up. So it's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. It pollutes the environment and it creates a lot of noise. Very bad. So the solution to that is a digitized garbage receptacle where there's a solar panel on the top, and the solar panel creates energy that compacts the garbage. And when it's ready to be picked up, it sends a signal to the command station. Okay, we're ready. Come pick us up. Yes. And not only that, but I did some research and found out that a couple of cities in Northern Europe that correlated the switch over to these solar panel garbage receptacles and a reduction in petty crime. So it's, if you have these receptacles with an open top and the garbage pouring all over on the ground, it gives a signal to criminals. If we can get away with polluting the ground, we can get away with other things. Similarly to what we did in New York City with the broken windows theory and cleaning up the graffiti on trains can reduce crime. But then we have an example, One Vanderbilt. This is a spectacular building right next to Grand Central. That's an example of a highly sophisticated and complex solution to transit, to buildings, and it's a showcase for public-private partnerships. It caused the entire rezoning of Midtown Manhattan.
So there are a lot of big projects, too, we're talking about architecture and design and public transportation systems, all sorts of things that people use every day.
Yeah, it's about a mindset of solving people's problems, problems from everyday experience, like crossing streets and having traffic lights that make sense vis-a-vis the flow of traffic and the need for pedestrians to cross highways and streets, to very complex design situations like city infrastructure, built environment. Take a look at Hudson Yards, for example, in New York City. That's an example of all kinds of new technology that was built in there. Great Wi-Fi, great connectivity, and also beauty, because smart cities are designed to make living more enjoyable, not only more efficient. So it's about creating beauty for an enjoyability in living and working in a smart city or in a smart office building.
What about smart buildings or green buildings, I guess? They're going to be playing a pretty big role in all of this.
Yes, there are many examples of smart buildings. In fact, there's a French company headquartered in France, but they have a big office in Andover, Massachusetts. And they are an example of an end-to-end A to Z smart building. So employees drive up there in their electric cars. They have electric charging stations outside the building. And when you go in, everything in there is designed for the maximum efficiency and effectiveness. Even they've redesigned the office space so that if you're working on a project, that project team sits together. So they've redesigned all of their cubicles, broken down into a way that there are units for people to work together in teams. Everything is practical. And so you get a tour of the building and you can see all of the different ways that smart technology can work for you in your building if you're considering any of their purchasing any of their systems.
Are there entire cities that are now smart cities, or are there cities that are most of the way there?
That's a great question. So it's a new concept, smart cities. So the buildings or the cities that are designed de novo, meaning from scratch, there are cities in China. Meishi Lake occurs to me. It's a magnificent city. It's actually a series of communities built around a lake, and it uses natural resources to create an environment that is perfect. And all of the technologies are perfect too. But there are many other buildings and cities too. For example, Singapore, they've really used their natural resources in a fantastic way. They rely on Malaysia for a lot of their water. And since water is vital to a city, they want to be self-reliant. So Singapore has the reputation of saving every drop of rain that falls. And it starts with their kids in school. It's drummed into them how important conservation of water is. They've become a center for water management and water research. And they have actually developed a way of taking wastewater and converting it, a complex process of filtration, ionization, and all kinds of other technologies, and making it potable into drinking water. So when they say they save every drop of water, they really mean it.
Well, I'm getting the impression that there are more cities outside of the United States that are a little more conscious of this kind of philosophy, and they're a lot further along than cities in the United States. Is that true?
That's a very good observation. Yes, the smart cities movement is more advanced in Europe. And I think that's because after World War II, a lot of cities were sort of decimated and they had to start from scratch. So they didn't inherit these big legacy infrastructures that we have in the United States. Estonia is one of those European situations. It's actually a city state. They had to, after the war and the Russians left, they had to really rebuild their government from scratch. They used the latest and greatest kinds of technology to do everything that was convenient and practical and low cost and longer range thinking for their citizens. You can do everything on a smartphone in Estonia except get married. Anything you need, you... And they might be working on how to do that, as a matter of fact. So anything you need, you want to register, you want to get a driver's license, you want to change your residency, change your voting party, you can do it on the phone. It's like a giant file cabinet that's fully digitized. It's really remarkable. And the Estonians go around the world as consultants, and they share their knowledge and help other companies, other cities, to get up to speed and be like them.
So how far away are we, Cornelia, from having these complete futuristic cities everywhere, like we saw as kids with the Jetsons? A decade away? 2 decades away?
Well, you see, there's a whole range. It's a whole continuum. And the Jetsons type of smart city is actually being built in Saudi Arabia, by Saudi Arabia. It's called Neom, and they're going to have flying cars and, very, very futuristic things because they're starting from scratch. But you'd be surprised. There are so many cities around the United States that have smart elements or components. In fact, the smart cities movement is really gaining a lot of momentum in the United States. There are more and more cities that are offering competitions and challenges that are led by, say, the Department of Transportation. One example that comes to mind is Columbus, Ohio, which won in, I think, 2016, a smart cities challenge. And there were 77 contestants that bid on a $40 million Department of Transportation contract. Columbus, Ohio won. It was a spectacular bid that they put in. And they made a case, one of the best cases I've seen, for extending their transit system, subways and buses, down below, outside of Columbus, into a poor area where their infant mortality rate was terrible and where they had very poor hospital care and very poor education. And the idea of extending the transit system down into this area was that the people living there could have better access into downtown Columbus for better health care and for jobs. It was a win for Columbus to bring in that whole community from the outside and from the community to improve their quality of life. And they made a compelling case, but they didn't hide their learnings and what they were doing and why they won from the other 77 participants. They were very open about sharing everything that they learned and everything that they did. And so the concept of a rising tide all boats. So everybody won who participated in the competition because they were able to share in the information. And that's how everything gets better.
Well, I would imagine, too, that you wouldn't have to start from scratch necessarily, that there are other ways that you can adapt, retrofit the things that you have in a city rather than just tearing everything down and starting all over again.
Sure. In order to do that, let's say you have traffic lights that need to respond adequately during an emergency. Let's say you have fires or police or emergency situations where you want all of the traffic lights to turn green in one direction where you want the police and fire to go. So what you'd want to do is replace the traffic light system with a smart system. One of them is called CertTrak. And you have to make sure when you replace your old legacy traffic light situation with a new system that will operate with the existing light poles and switches and everything else. You want to make sure that new components are compatible with what you have as you replace and retrofit old systems with new technology. And that is possible because a lot of these new innovations are based on open source technologies, open software and open hardware, meaning that they're free. The source codes are available to everyone. And so you can be assured that new traffic lights, for example, will work with your old traffic posts and with old systems and switches.
So I guess that would also cut down the expense, too. You can use some of what you've had before and change it into something new.
Yeah, it's an iterative process, and you want to take it a step at a time. It's an evolution, not a revolution.
As far as investors are concerned, looking at this whole big picture, what kinds of things should they be looking to invest in? What kinds of companies?
Well, if you're interested in smart cities, anything that pertains to reduction of CO2 emissions, clean energy, saving the planet, reforestation, causes involving certain communities like the disabled, very important for transportation, transit, subways. We're in a whole series of installing accessible metro systems in New York, elevators and subways. And that's a big project because we want to use the people resources that we have, including the disabled. We want them to be part of the community and be active. Telecommunications would be very important. Wi-Fi companies, companies that make sensors, anything involving data, because smart cities collect data and data needs to be processed, it needs to be stored, it needs to be analyzed. So companies that can analyze data that are involved with artificial intelligence, with machine learning, all of those are very, very hot companies and hot prospects for investment.
Well, Cornelia, you've seen a lot of things. You've seen what a lot of cities have done. You've done a lot of research into this, obviously. What really excites you about the smart cities movement? And what do you see looking down the road? Do you get really excited about?
So what excites me about smart cities is that everything is there. The stimulation, the culture, the education, the cross-fertilization, and the learning opportunities that come along with cities. But it's on steroids because it has also all of the new technologies that are fascinating and that can help people to have a better life and a better urban experience and work in a more enjoyable way. And certainly, I think the future is very bright. I see that the momentum will continue in smart cities. It's not going away. The demise of cities has been grossly over-exaggerated, to paraphrase Mark Twain.
Well, it's been great having you today. Is there any place people can go to for more information? I know in addition to your book, and we'll get the title in there again, are there other things that people can do, more research they can do, or just if they're curious about the whole topic?
I would suggest going online and just Googling smart cities because there are so many conferences And now with the pandemic, many of these conferences are free and they're very interesting. They're very inclusive. They have people from all walks of life and from all different countries and specialties. So there's a lot to be learned just from a simple online search about smart cities.
Okay, terrific. Thanks so much, Cornelia, for being with us today. It's been great.
Great to be with you.
We've been talking to Cornelia Levy-Bencheton, marketing consultant and smart cities expert, and author of the new book, Smart Cities, Smart Future, Showcasing Tomorrow. This podcast is copyrighted by Seasons of Advice Wealth Management. It is published and provided for informational and entertainment purposes only, and not for individualized investment advice. Please go to our website, soawealth.com, for additional information. We'll be back next time with more ESG stories in focus, and another deep dive discussion and companion articles in the Socially Inspired Investor Digest. Our podcast mission is to make socially inspired and ESG investing more consumer-friendly and achievable. This is the Socially Inspired Investor.